Well, welcome to X-Space, His Holy Church's X-Space call on capitalism, or kingdom capitalism. And we'll start off here in just a second. We're going through a study in Leviticus, trying to figure out what are these rituals concerning peace offerings, meat offerings, all these different types of offerings and these altars at the early stages of Israel in the Bible. And Leviticus is telling us about that. So I thought it would be appropriate to have a show on capitalism because a lot of people have also been coming up with the idea that Jesus was a socialist. And of course, we've written articles that Jesus was not a socialist. In fact, almost the entire Bible is talking about the fact that you don't want to be a socialist. Because socialism basically is desiring benefits at the expense of your neighbor. And that's probably as good a place to start as any, is this idea of capitalism. You know, there was a sign that says, under capitalism, man exploits man. But under socialism, the process is reversed. Which, of course, would be man exploits man. In socialism, you have a collective. And that collective divides what is produced by the collective according to somebody's design, from each according to his means, to each according to his needs. That's basically what socialism is, and we're going to come across that idea when we study capitalism. So one of the very first things that we need to do when we want to look at anything such as capitalism is define it, because there seems to be a lot of different definitions floating around out there in the minds of people as to what capitalism is. Capitalism is an economic system based on the private ownership of the means of production. And of course, socialism would be the antithesis of that, that the means of production is owned by the collective. Of course, the collective is not a single-minded creature, so the collective has to have some way of either deciding everything in a direct democracy, or electing somebody who will decide for them, and if they don't like what he decides, then you can elect somebody else. But socialism is this collective that owns the means of production. So that's one of the basic separate ideas of socialism and capitalism. And they say capitalism is an economic system in which the means of production is privately owned. And so they have these, you know, just wording it slightly different. But in these two definitions, we see that the means of is privately owned by the individual, and what may be produced is also going to be privately owned. Whatever he produces with the means of production. And in a number of definitions, you'll see that they'll say that the means of production doesn't include the individual. It's talking about things that the individual can own. But in reality, you can own all kinds of things and they won't produce anything except for the labor and sweat and toil of the individual. And so you really can't have capitalism unless the individual owns his own sweat, his toil, his right to work, his ability to make choices. Those are possessed by the individual, and those are as much a part as the means of production as anything else, because without those things, the assets that you call the means of production, machinery, wood, steel, minerals, all these commodities mean nothing without the ability to use them and implement them. So those are really kind of basic concepts that go along with capitalism. And socialism is the distinctive thing, is that it's some sort of collective and has to have some sort of political means by which to decide who gets what in that which is produced, or even how you produce things. You know, do you start a store? Do you start a factory in socialism? Well, who owns the factory? Well, the collective owns it. Well, how does the collective decide what we're going to make today? What we're not going to make today? We have a phenomena in the economies of Europe, and it's actually all over the world. Mundo Dragon, I think, is what they call it, but it's an actual cooperative where the Mundo Dragon, all the businesses that Mundo Dragon owns, like a corporation owns businesses, is owned by the collective of Mundo Dragon. It's a cooperative. And so it's all the factories are basically owned by the collective. Now, normally you would have, like we have here in our local community, a business called Bi-Mart. And it's a little bit like some things like ShopSmart or Walmart, etc. But it's owned by the employees of Bi-Mart. Well, what happens if you get fired? What happens if you quit? What happens if you retire? Do you still have the shares? Well, they have a way of figuring all that out, but it's basically a cooperative. But it's pretty small. You know, it owns, I don't know, 4 or 5 different stores, maybe more. And so it's not a gigantic thing. When you have a gigantic business that might be in the manufacturing and buying stocks one of the businesses that Mundo Dragon went into, they said that was not successful, was fishing. They were not successful at the fishing industry. And so they don't go there. They kind of have a taboo against going into, you know, creating a business where you're fishermen. And if you ever been fishing, I mean commercial fishing, you could almost see why. Because of the fact that, you know, one thing, you have to have a captain. And you can't rule a ship by the vote of the majority. It doesn't usually work unless it's a very small ship. So these are, when you play around with these ideas of capitalism and socialism and cooperatives, you have to keep going back to that fundamental definition of capitalism. And so we're going to go through a few of these variations. Like, capitalism is the name of the capitalist mode of production in which the means of production are owned privately by a small class of bourgeoisie who profit off the labor of the working class. Well, obviously that's a very biased definition. And it's a definition you might find in, you know, Karl Marx or some communist writing, where they think that capitalism is that they own the factory and all the workers are subjects and their labor is just being consumed by the factory and they're only paid a pittance and not the actual value of their labor. Of course, a lot of people want to think that way, but it doesn't always work out that way. Another definition, capitalism is a socioeconomic system based especially on private ownership of the means of production and the exploitation of the labor force. Again, you see this idea that somehow the factory is owned by some rich guy and they simply exploit the laborers. That it doesn't always work out that way in real life, although it could happen that way. But there's a lot of other factors. Remember, capitalism in its simplest form is simply an economic system. Well, if we went over and looked up a definition of socialism, we would see that it is an economic and political system. Well, there's a guy named John Peretti, and he owns BuzzFeed now. He's bought BuzzFeed. And he wrote an article, Peretti and the Capitalist Critique. And he redefines capitalism in his article. He's written a lot of articles, or published even more articles than he has written. He owns the Huffington Post now, etc. But in one of his articles, he wrote, what we mean when we say capitalism is the economic and political system in which a country's trade and industry are controlled by private ownership for profit rather than by the state or any other actor. Well, he's redefined capitalism. He's made it an economic and political system. Yet, the original definition of capitalism, it was simply an economic system and not political. It just meant that what you produced was yours. What you produced, you had the right, the property right in that. And people want to say, well, when did capitalism start? 1840s. They got lots of different dates. They'll go back. And they even talk about ancient capitalism. But the reality is the first squirrel was the first capitalist. He went out with his own energy and gathered nuts. He didn't do it as a collective. He did it as an individual. He stored those nuts. He hid those nuts. He put those nuts aside so that he would have something to eat in the winter. And he defended his stashes of nuts. And when he had young, often in the winter, with his mate, he would go out and gather up those nuts and bring back and share that food with his family. And he produced a family of squirrels who would eventually populate the trees of the woods. Well, some of the nuts he didn't find, and they would spring up eventually into more oak trees. And those would pass down to his ancestry, to his prodigy, to his children. That's capitalism, is that you not only have a right to the means of production, you have the right to the property that you produce. Like if you cut down a tree that was standing in the wilderness, or if you planted trees on land and you fenced off that land, you could develop a property right in that land, but you are limited to your labor. You are limited to your labor, your wife's labor, your children's labor, and maybe other people who wanted to work for you, their labor came in, but you would own them. In our recent studies in Genesis of Jacob, he was a capitalist. He accumulated wealth. He made deals with Laban, who was not really a capitalist, although he was partially a capitalist, but he believed in the system of governance that came down to him through Nahor and through Terah. And they were idolaters. And we've explained that as idolaters, that meant that they believed in a chain of authority, that they could have subjects under them from whom they could take a part of what they produce for themselves. Like you have sheep, and you feed the sheep, you protect the sheep, you help them lamb, you protect their lambs, and then you get to shear the sheep. And that idea of shearing the sheep is, and of course if you don't shear the sheep will die. Because the wool will just accumulate. They don't get rid of it on their own, usually. And so, you know, maybe a sheep might live 4 or 5 years without being sheared. But then, unless something removed the wool, he would eventually become incapacitated. So, it's a symbiotic relationship with the sheep. Well, we were explaining in our study of Genesis that shearing the sheep was sharing your possessions. You were taking a share from your possessions. The livestock of Jacob included all the people that followed Jacob, depended upon Jacob to be the authority over them. They were employees, servants, you could even say slaves, of Jacob. But Jacob did something different. He allowed his livestock, his people, to make their own sukkos. If you look at the translations, they will just say he's making sukkos for his animals. But no, he was actually allowing he says he made a house for himself, Jacob, and his family, but he allowed Sukkos, tents, structures for those that followed him, which they refer to as livestock, but we show you in our study of Genesis that livestock is actually his possessions, which included all these people that were traveling with him. They were his subjects, and this was different than what Nahor was doing, what Terah was doing, what Nimrod was doing, what Cain was doing with their city-states. The people were subjects in the city-states. They were the human resources of the city-states. But Jacob was doing something. He was letting the people own the means of their own production. But you still needed something. He was literally establishing capitalism amongst those people that followed him. Now, a lot of people aren't going to follow along with that, but it's important to mention that to give you some sort of framework to understand capitalism. He was establishing a capitalist society. If you went out and asked AI, give me all the quotes that in the Bible that establishes that God is for capitalism. And we'll take a look at what AI says about that, because they missed quite a few, in my opinion. But this is one of the ideas, is that he was establishing an economic system where the people had their own house. They would literally own their own sheep to some degree. He was empowering the people to take care of their own assets, their own household. They weren't just servants. They weren't just slaves to him. But they needed something else, because he did something else when he started doing that. He had to go out and establish something else. Because what he was saying was, okay, you get to own what you produce. These sheep are yours. They're your responsibility. I'm not going to come by and shear you like Judah did when he left his family. Laban did. He would go and shear his sheep. And if you go listen to our studies, you can get a follow up on understanding what that's all about. But what he was doing is creating a different system on how to redistribute that which you produced amongst the people. And it was these altars that he was creating. Because that's what he did. He went out and he built an altar. At the same time, he was empowering the people to have their own household. They weren't just the household of Jacob and one of Jacob's servants. They would have their own household. They would still fall under some sort of protective umbrella of Jacob. But they were given more right to choose over what they produced. And as my contention, what he was doing was establishing capitalism. And we'll go back even earlier in the Bible where there are quotes that suggest that God is a capitalist God. But this is the problem with capitalism, is that it is inadequate to form a nation or a society by itself. It's everybody's got their own stuff. I got my own sheep, I got my own orchard, I got my own things. And what I produce is mine, and that's not a nation, that's an individual. So how do you bind the people together as a nation? We know Laban, we know Nimrod, we know Abimelech, they bound people together. We know the Pharaoh bound people together as a nation. But if you give everybody their individual right to everything they produce, how do you form a nation? And to be fair, Johann Peretti sees that, well, that doesn't make any sense just to have everybody. It would be a scattered flock. Everybody would be doing their own thing. There'd be nothing binding people together as a nation. So he adds that it's also a political system in which the country's trade and industry are controlled by private owners. For the purpose, again, is for profit rather than by the state or any other actor. Well, actor is a person, and that will come into play, but So at least putting that out there, that he knows that you need something else, is very important, because capitalism on its own doesn't work as a nation. It's just a bunch of individuals doing their own thing. And you could create corporate capitalism. You could create crony capitalism. You could create, democratic capitalism, or a republic, and allow for capitalism. But all the other elements in society are going to have to be managed somehow. Because all Jacob did was gave them back a certain amount of power over what they produce. He wasn't going to share them, but he created these altars. And of course, if you following up on our Leviticus study and even on our study of Genesis and our study of Exodus, you'll see that these altars created by Moses were systems of social welfare that bound the people together, created the social bonds of society, because it was through free will offerings that they took care of the needy of society. So that if there was a war, if there was a famine, somebody would show up of a priest class to provide you with bread and food and wine and medical care or whatever it was that you needed. And you could do this on a local village basis or on a national basis, because it was expandable. And of course, when we come across Abraham and Melchizedek, Melchizedek was tied to, and when there was a war and there was going to be wounded and injured, etc., he shows up with food and supplies. And of course, that Melchizedek was called a righteous king of peace, because he had the wealth that he had to share, not for profit, but as a benefactor of the people. And because Abraham had tied to him, he came to Abraham's assistance. And of course, Jesus is called the priest forever under the order of Melchizedek. And he created a system of social welfare that has come down to us, and now today we call the church. But 90% of the welfare that people consume as Christians, or even as Jews, or as Muslims, 90% of it doesn't come from their church, or their synagogue, or their mosque, but it comes from the government. And you'll find these people, amongst these people, you'll find Christians against capitalism, and for capitalism, and for socialism, and they're all over the place. But they don't realize that Christ was creating a system of capitalism and a system of altars, just like Jacob was creating a system of altars and a system of capitalism, where you had the right to your own household and what your household produced. But you knew, once you understood the system, that you have to share. So what you produce, a portion of it is not for profit. A portion of it is for the welfare of your neighbor, in a network that is following this same capitalist charitable system. It's not a political system. It involves the people, but it's not a political system of authority, because the offerings have to be free will. And we see that now more and more. We saw it in Exodus, in our study of the altars of Moses, and more so now in Leviticus. All the offerings have to be free will. They talk about tithing. Tithing is a free contribution. It's supposed to be, some people say 10%, but it's a share. Because they're organized in groups of 10, it's a share of the 10. What you share might be different than what I share. Who are you answerable to? Well, you're not answerable to me. You're not answerable to the king. You're not answerable to anybody but your conscience. But if you don't share, then there won't be enough bread for the needy. And chances are, as you judge, so shall you be judged, so there won't be enough bread for you. So you're creating a system, a capitalist system, that all that you produce is not for profit. It's so that you have gain an increase. Of course, anybody who is a working man knows I go out and do 10 hours worth of work. I spent 10 hours in sweat and toil. I went out the other day and we went out in the morning. We worked all day, my wife and I, and I didn't get breakfast till dinner time because we never came in. We just kept working. That's the way we often do things. We don't do that every day anymore, but we did that. I spent time working, none of which probably made me much profit, but it was work that is these projects that we put off because we're busy every day doing something. So you take a day and we're going to tend to this that we haven't tended to for 5 years or 10 years, and we accomplish that. But there's an expenditure. Whatever gain I get back from that is the result of that expenditure. And you will only be able to do that for your lifetime, and eventually you won't be able to do that as much. And you say, well, I produced all this with what? The expenditure of my life, of my time, my sweat. My life is in the products I produce. My flocks or my herds or if I manufacture something, they are the result of the products that I produce. My life is in those products. This is going to be very important when we start putting all this together into kingdom, because literally my blood and my sweat is in the products that I produce. If you come along and say you have a right to a portion of those products and want to take them away from me, you're going to take away some of my blood, some of my life. And of course now in our study in Leviticus 3, just yesterday, we were explaining a great deal that your life is in the blood. It says this over and over again in the Bible. And it also says you're not to eat meat with blood in it. You're not to take a bite out of one another. Well, in socialism, you can take a bite out of your neighbor. That's okay. It's legal to take a bite out of your neighbor. It may be regulated, but we give you the example when it talks about the cities of blood in the Bible, and the city will be our cauldron, and we will be the flesh. They're describing a socialist state, a socialist city-state, where you are the human resources, and anybody who eats the benefits of that city, consumes the benefits of that city, may be eating meat with blood in it. In other words, if you're a lazy worker, you're still going to get a house. You're still going to get a paycheck. You can say, oh, well, I didn't see that, or I didn't. You're not really giving your all to the production. You're either going to take a bite out of your neighbor who does give it his all, or you're going to elect somebody who will favor you and give you what you want. And we see this today. You know, people will say America is a capitalist nation. It has a capitalist economy. It doesn't. It has a socialist economy. You have vast numbers of people on welfare. And they don't all need to be on welfare. Of course, they all will assure you that they do need to be on welfare. But anything they eat is provided by men who exercise authority and have already previously taken away what they eat from their neighbors or borrowed against the future. That's not capitalism. We haven't had capitalism in the United States for 100 years. Not real capitalism. Everybody says, well, you know, you point out, well, socialism failed here and socialism failed there. And it says, well, that's not real socialism. Well, the reason the United States economy is failing today, and it hasn't really got all that bad yet, but there are failing signs of failing showing, is it's not really a capitalist nation. For one thing, what you're paid is not capital. It's promises. They're notes. You've gotten away from just weights and measures. You can't have capitalism unless you have actual value that you're paying one another and exchanging with one another. And you don't have that, generally speaking, anymore in the United States. As a matter of fact, if you did go back to barter, you would probably get arrested for failing to pay income tax. And we could go into that, but that might be a sidetrack. And we want to open this up for questions here shortly. But this idea that you have a capitalist nation in the United States or a capitalist economy, you don't. You take money from your neighbor to create the government. You take money from your neighbor to create the police force. Your government has created, if you read the Constitution as it is today, most people don't understand the Constitution as it is today. Even I can show you in 1933, in the foreword of Clark Summary of U.S. American Law, they were saying lawyers are being graduated every day who have no understanding of the Constitution. And yet this was back in 1933, it hasn't gotten any better. And even, I have my father's law books that he was using back in the 1945 after World War II when he was becoming a lawyer. And every single chapter is full of underlining. He was a big underliner. And I don't put marks in books. I don't underline. It's just like taboo to me. But he was a big underliner. But in the chapter on the Constitution, there's almost not a single mark. And I would have to believe it wasn't because my father wasn't diligent and underlining in those statutes, because they didn't get to teaching that in Creighton Law University. And, he read some of my earlier books or my earlier writings, and he was one of my first advocates telling me that, what I was writing was true. And of course now I've written books that include the Constitution. But I'm going to leave you with a few biblical quotes on kingdom capitalism, the ones that AI was willing to admit to and the ones that AI didn't even bring up. And of course, there's hundreds more that, and, just as I was saying, going through Genesis and studying what made Jacob Israel was the fact that he was restoring every man to his family and every man to his possessions. That was a process that was going to take some learning skill on the part of the people. So he had to create an environment in which they would have to learn these things. And of course, now that we're studying what Moses was doing, we're going to see a lot more detail. We don't see a lot of detail in Genesis, just that he created an altar. But what he was doing was restoring every man to his possessions so that they would own the means of production, which is basically, they didn't necessarily own all the mountains or all the trees around them and all the fields around them, but they could develop a property right in them. We can go down that road. That's a complex, not really complex, it's pretty simple to understand property rights. But you have to get rid of the idea that people would have a property right if you're going to create a communist socialist nation. You would have to make private property rights some sort of wicked demon thing. But it's not. It's very, 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 very simple. And it's the only thing that could be considered just, right, and fair. But let's run through these few quotes that I've set aside that promote the idea of kingdom capitalism. And of course, one of the first ones is in the first chapter of the Bible, Genesis 1, verse 28. Where it says, "And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish, the sea, over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Well, that's dominion over. That's like own it. And that he's giving you dominion from the beginning. He's not giving it to the collective. He's giving it to Adam and Eve, a family. He's instituting the family and the right that the family gets to own, and that that family can be fruitful, have children, and pass down the fruits of their labor, their blood, sweat, and tears into the hands of their family when they pass away. Hopefully their days will be long upon the land, and we can talk about what God says in order to make that happen. But that's one of the very first quotes that to me screams of capitalism in Genesis 34:10. Because we're going to jump right along, because I'm only going to pull out a few quotes. It says, "And ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you, and dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein." Now, that to me screams of capitalism. And we're going to see that Jesus gives a parable about that idea of accumulating possessions based on what you have and investing it and producing more. You know, I always remember a guy, you know, I've read a lot of stories about sheep and sheepers. There was a sheeper, you know, out in the West, you know, over 100 years ago, back in the 1800s. And he had like 1,000 sheep. And he was just going through the mountains and through the valleys and the hills with his sheep. And they were having lambs and producing more, and he was protecting them, and, you know, I think this is in Wyoming somewhere, and he got caught in a snowstorm, a freak snowstorm where it snowed real deep. I mean, it just buried the sheep in the snowstorm. Recently, there were snowstorms in Russia where I saw a man shoveling sheep that were just buried in the snow, so you just see their heads peeking out through the snow. We've had snow like that, freak snows, as late as May out here in the high deserts, and we lost lambs. We didn't lose any sheep that wasn't quite that deep, but lambs were covered up, and they just lay there, you know, because it's windy and blowing, and they just try to curl up and stay warm, and the snow covers them, and they suffocate if you don't get out there and uncover them. We uncovered a lot of them, but a few of them didn't make it. They suffocated under the snow. But he lost the whole band. The whole band of sheep. They all died. They were all just buried in the snow. He didn't save a single one. But he went back up there. He made his way out and got some more supplies. Went back up there. They're all still buried in the snow. They're going to be in the snow till spring. And he started, you know, cut firewood, built a camp and a shelter, and then he just started cutting all the sheep out of the snow, just digging them out of the snow one at a time. And every time he dug them out, he would thaw them out and skin them and flesh the hides and dry them and just kept stacking them up. And he would eat. He had all the meat he wanted, so he's eating a lot of sheep meat, just 1,000 sheep. He dug them all out, as many as he could find, and of course they're all frozen, and they'll be frozen till spring. And he had piles and piles of sheep fleeces, skinned, fleshed, dried, huge amount of work. Just, it's almost unfathomable, the amount of work. Spent all winter doing it. And when he had come back up, he came up with wagons. He filled the wagons with these piles of sheep hides, all stretched out, all dried, all preserved now because they're dried, took them down and to a railroad eventually and sold them, and then went out and bought another flock of sheep and started all over again. So that's capitalism. If that happened in a communist country, nobody's going to take that kind of investment. But in that man's stack of fleeces and hides was his sweat and blood. And nobody, in my opinion, has a right to any portion of them. But in Leviticus 25:10, now we're shifting gears. We've jumped all the way through Exodus, and now we're in Leviticus, and he says in verse 10, it starts, "And ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee, a celebration unto you, a good thing for you to do this. And ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family." And this is repeated in verse 13 and verse 27 and verse 28. And that reeks of capitalism. It's not return every man to the collective, but return them to, and this is published, this is in the 50th year. And so, we will do this in our study of Leviticus, that's all the way up in Leviticus 25, we're way down, next is Leviticus 4. But, everybody knows, we don't have any record of a year of Jubilee, but we do have a record of the idea that after 7 years, that, yeah, you could sell your land, but normally you could only sell it for 7 years. But you could create a situation where you actually ended up selling it for 49 years, and at which time it's supposed to revert back to the original family. You can't sell the land forever. You could sell it for a period of time. And this was built into the system by Moses so that they never centralized all the wealth in the country in the hands of a few people. But for a period of time, you could do this. For 7 years, or maybe as many as 49 years. But then it was to revert back to the people. But if you were actually doing all the other provisions that Moses clarifies through Leviticus and Deuteronomy, you will have wealthy men. And they will own lots of land, and they will have servants, and they'll have people working for them. But they will be empowering all the people around about them. They won't be centralizing all the wealth in the nation in the hands of the few. Now, you could go the way of Karl Marx and try to prevent that centralization of wealth through communism and socialism, but that's not a good way. What Moses had a much better way, if you actually knew what Moses said. For one thing, there was no professional police force. There was no need for a professional police force because everybody was responsible for justice. Because all the courts in Israel were people's courts. And all the appeals courts in Judea and Israel were supposedly operated by men who were in the charity business. And we'll explain that in our article on cities of refuge. But for make this short so we get through these quotes and we can open up to questions, is that the idea God wants you to own your labor and invest your labor in being fruitful and multiplying your family, but he also wants you to love your neighbor as yourself. So all the stuff that you produce cannot be simply for profit for you and your family. In Ecclesiastes, we explain that there, that you, if it isn't just about not coveting your neighbor's goods, but not coveting your own goods to the point of forgetting about your neighbor. And Christ has quotes, and we'll see New Testament quotes, and Proverbs has quotes that remind us of that. The next one I put in place here in the list on the page is Obadiah 1:17. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. But it will not possess the people. The people will be free, because the house of Jacob possesses his possessions, but in order to be called Israel, he has to return every man to his family. Now, there's a country over there in the Middle East, and they call that Israel. But the people don't actually own their houses. They don't actually own their labor. There's heavy progressive income tax. You know, it was only 20% income tax in Egypt. But in the land over there in Israel today, you can pay at least 70%, certainly 30%. Which is more than they did in the bondage of Egypt. But they make excuses because it's for Israel, but it's still compelled. I mean, you could go to jail if you don't contribute to that government. But yet, to contribute to the government of Israel under Moses was a free will offering. It wasn't compelled by civil law. So there's right away we can see a distinction between what that Israel is doing and what Moses was doing, and certainly what Jacob was doing, who was the first to be called Israel. But of course, we have the same problem in the United States. We have the same problem in Israel. We have the same problem in Canada, the same problem in Australia, the same problem in Guatemala. Wherever you go, they all have some sort of income tax. And that means that the labor of the people is not entirely theirs. They are in a pot, a flesh pot. They're in the cauldron. And a portion of their labor can be taken away from them by law, by men who exercise authority. That's not capitalism. Capitalism, you get to decide how much you want to give and how much you don't want to give. That was according to the order of Melchizedek. That was according to Christ. That was according to Moses. But it's not according to Christians, Jews, and Muslims who all claim to follow Christ or Moses or Abraham. Because Abraham was learning that that's why Abraham built altars as well and taught other people how to build altars. To create a society that operates on faith, hope, and charity. And you need that. You need that aspect separate from your capitalism. It's literally the separation of church and state. You're the state in a state of freedom in a capitalist economy. What you produce is yours. You can decide that it's all just for you. Ecclesiastes tells you not to do that. Jesus tells you not to do that. Jacob didn't do that. Laban would do that. But that's the way of the idolaters. Because, and Paul tells you, that covetousness is idolatry. Well, he's talking about coveting other people's stuff. Well, how would you even have an access to other people's stuff? You have to create a corporate government, a cauldron, a city of blood, and everybody pool part of their labor into that cauldron. That's the bondage of Egypt. When they pooled part of their labor into the bondage of Egypt, 20% of their labor belonged to the government. But if you make a different contract with some other civil government, they may get to up the 20% to 30% or 40% or 50% or whatever. You know, it depends on the deal you make, the covenant you make with your government, the contract with your government. This is why it's so important that people actually understand things like the Constitution, state laws, what you're signing up for whenever you sign things, and people don't. And so they get themselves into trouble. Now we go to Exodus 20, and we say, you shall not steal. Thou shalt not steal. And we can go to Exodus 20 and verse 17. Thou shalt not covet your neighbor's house or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So we can see that as well in our examination of the scriptures. And of course, socialism is about coveting your neighbor's goods. And a lot of people say, and you know, I've mentioned a fellow if you look up taxation at preparingyou.com, we quote people who say taxation is theft. Taxation is really not theft. It often is the result of covetous practices, but taxation, if it's legal taxation, and that's why you need to read the Constitution to find out what you're getting into, or read the, I mean, how many people have read the Social Security Act? How many people know why you owe income tax? You can have a big imagine, but the reality is that the people were in the bondage of Egypt. They owed 20% income tax to the Pharaoh. 20% of what they produced belonged to the Pharaoh, didn't belong to them. Only 80% belonged to them. So that's the beginning of socialism. Because capitalism, 100% belongs to you. But if you start with 10%, it's going to belong to somebody else, or 20% is going to belong to somebody else, you're straying from capitalism. And now you're moving. If you can pay 50% income tax, you're way away from capitalism. And if you're paying that tax with notes rather than actual substance, because you don't even have the right to own substance, not lawfully own substance. But anyway, that another whole long story. But 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10, for even when we were with you, we would give you this commandment. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. Socialism, you can do a poor job and still eat. And of course, I know personally people that were hired by the Russian government when they had perestroika and they were trying to return all these government-owned companies. There were, you know, they had lots of different industries that were owned by the government. The people worked there. The people produced a product, but they weren't producing enough. And so in perestroika, they were trying to return these businesses to the workers. You will own them. They will literally hand the worker the business. He's not going to have a guaranteed pay. He's got to make the business work. He doesn't have to buy it. He doesn't have to work for 20 years. He doesn't have to spend all winter, you know, skinning sheep in the snow in order to get the capital to buy more sheep and be in the sheep business. They're just going to give him the sheep. But he's got to make a profit, because he's not going to get a wage from the government unless he makes a profit. He's got to make, you know, he's being handed the keys to the ranch. In this case, it was fish processing plants. And he was going to go in and show the people how to efficiently run their fish processing plants that they had been running for years at a loss because it were government owned and they weren't doing it efficiently. And he was going to show them how to do it efficiently. And I met him right after he got back from spending months in Russia. And I said, so how'd it go? And he says, they're genetically bankrupt. And that was his first line. And then he explained, you can't give these, they don't want the business. They just want the check. They don't want, they're given the business. They can make it, they have all the asset already built for them. And they don't want it. They just want the check. And he says everybody who had any initiative or any gumption had already fled over the Iron Curtain or just been dead. Solzhenitsyn tells the story of, you know, where he had the teacup and an ant in the teacup. And the ant's going, and he tries to climb out, and the guy would just push the ant back down. Every time he tried to climb out, he just gently push him back down to the bottom of the cup. And eventually the ant doesn't try to climb out of the cup anymore. He's lost his incentive. And this is what he saw in Russia. Now, of course, after years and years, there's a lot of people, unfortunately, the first people to get enthusiastic about making money was the mafia, the Russian mafia. But a lot of people are now. But he told me about a young boy who's 9 years old. He gave him a book and he gave me the book. I still have it. And he said he was going to be the future of Russia. Of course, he's all grown up now. I would love to find out. I've got his name in the book. I don't know if I could ever find him in Russia. But the reality is you needed another generation because one generation was dead. It was genetically destroyed. He says he used the word genetically, but emotionally, incentive-wise, it was destroyed. This is happening in America. It's been happening for dozens of years, decades and decades. And this is why I encourage people to homeschool and to create their own home business, that very kingdom-oriented. You're not going to jump into the kingdom. There's a learning curve. But you have to accept the idea that you can't take a bite out of your neighbor. You can't have your cauldron where you be the flesh and depend upon that. You can't covet your neighbor's goods, anything that is your neighbor's. And the governments of today and all the countries I've already mentioned, they are only going to give you benefits that they either first took away from your neighbor by force or borrowed against the future of your neighbor's children. And that's going to provide you with your benefits. And that's against the kingdom. That's against the teachings of Moses and the teachings of Christ and the teachings of Paul. And it is idolatry. So then we get into the New Testament, Matthew 25, 14 through 30. He tells a whole parable here of, you know, the guys that were given 5 talents, 2 talents. We'll just go through it real quick. And 1 talent. They go out and invest it and make something of it. They produce more with what they were given. And that's what we're all given. You're given a piece of land, maybe not given. You went out and earned it. And you worked at it. You invested your blood, your life, your sweat into making this farm, this desert, this ranch, this company, this factory. You made it successful. You know, we'll use Elon Musk, although that will trigger a lot of people because there's such a resentment to Elon Musk because he's so rich and they think he does everything for profit. And you've actually heard out of his own mouth that, where people wanted him to curb his speech and not say certain things, you know, because you're going to lose money. And he says, I don't care. Money. It doesn't matter. I'm going to say what I want to say. And you can say, well, it's just bravado. But the reality is I think he really has taken risks with lots of money. And he's employed tens of thousands of people with good wages. Loyal employees, because he treats them pretty good, evidently. I haven't heard otherwise, except for maybe one disgruntled guy. And I'm sure there's more. But the reality is he demands a certain type of work ethic. You can't bring negative emotions. He doesn't like that. You want to have negative emotions, go work for somebody else. That you have to think of yourself as a team, etc. He's got a lot of good qualities. Is he perfect? Certainly not. But like I say, thousands upon thousands of people have jobs, good paying jobs, and have accomplished amazing things because of his organizational and ingenuity and his he's a great asset to society, you know, and you can find fault with it, but he certainly has accomplished a lot more than a lot of the people that are coming up that don't have nearly the skill he does. And he has often done this by taking everything that he produced. It's not like Bill Gates. Bill Gates, you can go through his history and find out that he robbed a lot of his competitors. There's no two ways about it. He was a ruthless businessman. You can say the same thing about, you know, some of these other guys. They were just ruthless businessmen. Doesn't appear that's been Elon Musk. But of course, I will get off into personalities. We don't want to do that. But in that parable, he was praising those who received these assets and made them become fruitful and multiply and increase them. You know, you give a person a plot of land and you say you grow a garden there, and you come and you see this guy's garden and you see that guy's garden and you say, I'm going to give this guy more ground because this guy really produced on this little bitty ground. I'm going to give him more. You know, because he produced so much. I mean, that's just common sense. And that seems to be a common sense idea in the kingdom. And then I put in, you know, Proverbs 10:22, the blessings of the Lord makes rich and he adds no sorrow with it. Goes on to 13:22, the good man leaves an inheritance to his children. One of the things you know that you're moving towards socialism when they want to create an inheritance tax. And of course, they've already done this in many places. And many socialists want to do away with all inheritance. You don't need inheritance. You're just going to be a part of the collective. You're going to be a cog in the machine. We'll take care of you. Yeah, but you'll be a possession. Man is not an ant. Man is not a honeybee. Man was created to be individuals. Because he has that right to choose. He's, you know, you take away that right to choose, you know, our Archibald MacLeish quote, and you become a person, a thing, an instrument. And socialism wants to make you an instrument. And to be faithfully true, a lot of people only want to be instruments. They only want to be employees. Maybe they don't have the mental capacity to run their own business. But they do get up. They do go to work. Sometimes they need a little motivation. Hopefully not with a whip. But they need a little motivation. And that's the total of their capacity. And we should find a place for them. But if you don't work, you don't eat. That's a very kingdom principle. It's what saved Jamestown Colony. Because they wanted to keep the common storehouse. And it was John Smith, I think it was, who said, when they were quoting, you know, we have to take care of people, we need the common storehouse. But people don't realize that when you have a common storehouse and somebody is handing out the favors, the bread, the grain, whatever is in your common storehouse, they have power. And that's where strange fire comes in. But I don't want to get off on that tangent. But we can read in Ephesians 4:28, let him that stole steal no more. We could say the same about coveting. But rather let him labor, working with his hands, the things which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth. So you produce what you need. But you're also going to have to give to others. Because when you give to others, it creates loyalty amongst you. But why can't we just give to others directly? Why do we have to have altars and priests? Because if you become a rich man and you give directly to the poor will have loyalty to you, but not the rest of the community. You know, the first policemen in communities are hired by the rich men. And if you create a corporate community, you will be taxed to hire the policemen. And you will need policemen. We need policemen today. If you took away all the policemen, you'd have total chaos. But like I said, I don't believe in defunding the police. I believe in making the police superfluous. And in the kingdom, every man, family is his own, and every man's possession is his own. You're not there. It's going to take some learning. It was going to take some learning in our study on Exodus. This is why God hardened the heart of the Pharaoh, because the people weren't ready for freedom. Most people aren't ready for freedom. They want freedom, but they don't understand in order to have freedom, you have to take on responsibilities, and you have to do that responsibility in a collective, but not a collective of authority, top-down authority. But a collective of love, mutual love for one another. If you go to the priest and you say, I lost my job, we don't have enough food this week, we're going to need some help, you know, all my sheep are snowed in on the mountain and everything I had was tied up in those sheep. I need to go up there and skin them out and stretch out those hides in order to create an asset. Will you loan me a wagon? And I will take the wagon up. And now, okay, I don't know exactly how he did it, but I can imagine because I've had horses under, harness. And, so he's going to go up there to where the snow is 2-3 feet deep in the mountains. And he's going to skin out all his sheep and he's going to take a wagon up there with supplies. Okay. He's going to go all the way up there. With his supplies, he's going to park that wagon up there. He can't keep those horses up there. He's got to bring the horses back down. The guy who's loaning him the wagon may bring him up and he takes the horses down. And the guy just stays with the wagon and skins out all the sheep and loads the wagon. And then the guy, in the springtime, the guy comes up with the horses again and brings the wagon back down. There's a lot of work in this, cooperation. But he had somebody that, you know, I don't know if he had money to borrow that wagon, but it's very likely somebody loaned him the wagon. Or maybe just took up the supplies and took the whole wagon back down and came back up with it later to load up the hides. But this is what the church should be doing. You shouldn't need to go to a bank, although a church is not a bank, but you would go to your community. and your community would loan you the money to start your business. They would know you. They would trust you. I did a video for lawyers back in 2007 to explain the kingdom to them. And a few people have seen it. We still have it on DVD. I should try to incorporate it. It's not that great, but it explains how the early Christian community worked. And it worked with capitalism. But it had this other element called the church, the Corban of Christ, whatever you want to call it, so that they didn't need a political government to divide your assets amongst the needy of your society. You chose who you would give to, what ministry you would go to, and his full-time job was to make sure, you know, maybe not his full-time job, but at least his part-time job was to make sure that the needy were not neglected. That was pure religion. The Romans called it private religion. Their religion through the government temples was called public religion. Today, your religion in what you think is a capitalist economy is public religion. That 90% of your welfare is provided by men who exercise authority through the civil law to collect from you your contribution. That's the Corban of the Pharisees. That's making the word of God to none effect. It's destroying your children. It's destroying your community. It's dividing the people so that you have chaos in the street. You will eventually turn people into perfect savages. You will need more and more police in order to maintain order with those perfect savages. We see that unfolding right now. But the problem isn't the police. The problem is you're not following Christ. You're not seeking the kingdom of God and the righteousness of God. You're seeking the kingdom of Nimrod. You're seeking Babylon, the collective state. And you need to repent of that and turn around and go the other way. So you have 1 Timothy 6:6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world. And the word world there is constitutional order or system of government. And it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts. I have an article that's linked to at preparing you in our article on capitalism where you find these listed in a footnote. But we have an article, foolish. Saul did a foolish thing. He forced an offering of the people to support the military. You guys do that every day. Israel does that every day. Samuel said that was foolishness and that your government wouldn't stand. They would collapse and fall. Because you're forcing the offerings of the people. You're diverting a free society into that cauldron of flesh, where somebody can sit up there as the prime minister or president and say that you're going to have to give. That I'm going to take away from you to provide for others. I'm going to redistribute your wealth, your blood, your sweat, your tears to who I think it ought to go to. You don't have any choice in the matter. You're just merchandise. You're just a human resource. That's where you're at today. You go to your churches, you can sing your songs, but you've returned to the yoke of bondage, the bondage of Egypt. You've abandoned the way of Christ for the ways of Nimrod, and now you're in secret Babylon. You're in mystery Babylon. You can start changing that anytime you want to start repenting and thinking differently, and we're giving you some of the things to think differently with. When it goes on in verse 10 of 1 Timothy 6, it says, for the love of money is the root of all evil. And that love of money, it's actually a particular word in the Greek, philaguria, which comes from philagurios, which is translated covetousness. That's really what the word means. Every place. Philargyros, which comes from two words, one being friend of silver. That's kind of what it means. So they refer to it as love of money or avarice when you're talking about it as a noun. But it actually has to do with covetousness. And you desire benefits from men who exercise authority. Jesus said it wasn't to be that way with you, but it is that way with you. You're not a capitalist society. You're somewhere between the kingdom of God and Mystery Babylon. And you're a lot closer to Mystery Babylon than you are to the kingdom. But I'm sure you can find a minister that will tickle yours and make you feel good. But I would rather you see the truth of the kingdom and seek it. And how to seek it? Well, we can talk about that. But I got one more quote here that I'll go into, because if you go on to chapter, verse 11. But thou, O man, God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. So stop looking for more benefits, Social Security, welfare, free education, SNAP, even police protection, all these things. Stop looking to the government for those things. Start coming together in the tens, hundreds, and thousands and seek the righteousness of God, which is that is found in the practice of pure religion, where you take care of the widows and orphans through faith, hope, and charity. And if you don't want to do that, that's fine, but you will not be free. You will maybe be a rebel, but you will remain in the yoke of bondage. And the last quote is Acts 4:32. And the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and of one soul. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. That is the only reason I put it here, because it doesn't really reek of capitalism. It actually sounds a little bit like socialism, all things in common, and people constantly run to that. So I've written a whole article, All Things Common, and what they're really talking about when they say, of them that believe, he's talking about the ministers of the church. You've gone so far away from what the early church was doing, you don't even know the distinction. There were families in free assemblies we call congregations. Moses called them free assemblies. But they're not corporations. They're free assemblies. The right of the people to peaceably assemble. So there's no corporation. It's not an unincorporated association even. And what keeps it, if see, an unincorporated association in the laws of the United States is treated as a corporation. If the corporation can offer you limited liability, but it can also create responsibility. So if your congregations, and I can show you this in law all the way back to the American Revolution. If your congregation is an unincorporated association and somebody in your congregation does something, you all could be liable. But if you're free assemblies, no, you can't be. And there's a way to protect yourself in that. And it will be important to figure these things out. But basically, the kingdom of God, like I said, you know, the squirrels hoards his nuts, and a bee gathers his honey without knowing what they do, and they are thus provided for without selfishness or disgrace. Well, that's Ralph Waldo Emerson who said that. But the squirrel doesn't do it like the honeybees and the ants. The honeybees and the ants are collectives. The squirrel does this. The squirrel is the true capitalist. Socialism works if you're a honeybee. It's a little hard on the drones, but the worker bees all work themselves to death. But the hive goes on. But you're not a honeybee; you're a man, and so you need to find out what kingdom capitalism is and pursue that. But anyway, there's a whole page at preparingyou.com on capitalism. I'm always reorganizing it and putting things together, trying to lay this out piece by piece. But corporate capitalism, by its very nature, is not capitalism. Corporate capitalism is going back to that line where it says, let's build us a city, and the city will be our cauldron, and we will be the flesh. Now, any government that decides to create a corporation or give a personhood to a corporation, which we did with the, I think it was the 14th Amendment, where a corporation was given personhood in the United States. That's a bad thing. But it was done. It's a real thing. But corporations don't necessarily die. And so corporations immediately have an advantage over the individual. So most individuals go out and incorporate. And there's lots of different ways in which to do that. But the family was the first corporation. And God created the family. We saw that with the very first quote. That the family is the institution of God. It's two or more people gathered together under the pre-existing authority of God. Unless, of course, they go under some other authority. For a particular purpose. And that purpose is to be fruitful and to multiply. Which you can do in a capitalist economy. As soon as you start moving towards a socialist economy, now your fruit, part of your fruit ain't yours. It belongs to the collective. You're moving towards the hive mentality. Why would you do that? Well, if you don't have any system of social welfare, you don't have any system of protection against foreign foes. I mean, 10 guys could come in and beat you up and steal your wife and your children and take all your stuff. So you need to have somebody there that will back you up, and you need to have some sort of loyalty with other people. I mean, you could buy slaves and servants, but that's not really going to give you the kind of protection that you really are going to need. But if you create altars, like Abraham did, and taught people how to be free souls under God, but yet dependent. So they were all capitalists. They had their own property. They had their own family groups, etc. But they created these altars, and these altars created a system of social safety net so that it created bonds between you and the other people. They weren't contractual bonds, you know, like peace treaties. Or leagues, as it's often translated in the Bible. We're not supposed to do that. That's one of those commandments. So what binds people together is this faith and charity and love for one another. You guys were there. You loaned me a wagon and a team of horses so that I could go up and salvage my sheep. I'm going to owe you to the day I die because you saved me. You saved my bacon. So to speak. So this creates these bonds, and they create a whole system to keep replenishing those bonds. They're not all going to the rich guy. But the rich guy, you know what he's going to have to do? He's going to depend upon all these other people. He's going to give a lot, but he doesn't give directly to people. He gives to the priests. And the priests have a particular status, which is that owning all things in common, which you can study on your own later. We have plenty of articles on that. But Jesus required it of his ministers. You don't see the ministers of modern Christianity doing it. But Jesus did require it. It's right there in the text. They're not going to point it out. Moses required it of the Levites. It was required in Egypt, of the priests in Egypt. It was required in Babylon, of the priests of Nimrod. But most people don't even know what that is. But it was the fact that the priests owned all things in common. They couldn't make themselves individually rich because they owned all things in common. But with the other priests, the other ministers of the altars of Christ, owned all things in common. And we can explain a dozen different ways why that's important. But as soon as you are creating corporations, you're putting the individual at a disadvantage. But as soon as that individual gathers like Christ said to gather, like Moses said to gather, like we see Jacob gathering, he becomes stronger. He becomes actually feared by the powers of the world. And the Abimelechs of the world will respect you because you have something else on your side. Now, that's going to take some faith. I can't explain exactly how that works, but that's going to take some faith. But so you won't need to create a police force. There is a police force out there for the people who have gone away from the ways of Christ, and they need that police force in order to maintain order. But more and more of them are becoming perfect savages and actually warring against the police force. But the real wicked powers that be want you to war against that police force, want you to become antagonistic to it. And what happens is that I know from personal experience what happens is the good policemen who really want to protect the people feel so unappreciated, they quit. And it creates an imbalance in the character of the policeman that you get. But it's all your fault because you're not going the way of Christ. So you want to repent and turn around your thinking and start going the way of Christ. You know, some people complain about capitalism because it's an ism. And they don't like isms. You know, they have a prejudice against anything that is ism. Because what they're really talking about is ideology. This is often people with an attitude of jealousy and superiority. The negative ideas connected to an ism is usually projections of their own prejudice at best, and or their ignorance, or both. But it is true, you know, ism is just a suffix on the end of a word to distinguish something as a practice, a system, a philosophy, typically a political ideology or an artistic movement. But the reality is that capitalism is not an ideology. It's not necessarily a philosophy. It's not even really a system. It's just saying that the labor of the individual, we'll touch on property rights. What are property rights? If you fence off a piece of ground that nobody has any claim to, I'll bring Greenland into this, so that you kind of make an association with it, or the Louisiana Purchase, or even the purchase of Alaska, where we purchased large tracts of land. There were people living on that land at the time. There were people that owned, you know, people always talk about, like, we took the land from Mexico. You know, Arizona, New Mexico, Southern California, they said, oh, well, you stole that from Mexico. No. We paid for it. The United States paid Mexico for that land. And they cashed the check. They consented to it. It's not stolen land. It was paid for. And when the United States paid for that land and Mexico cashed the check, we honored all the land grants, Spanish land grants, to Spanish people. All the people lived on that. They didn't have to move out. You know, it was like Nehru, when he kicked all the Jews out of Egypt. I remember when he did that. I know some of the Jews that he kicked out of Egypt. They literally just loaded them on the boat. They, all the money that was in their bank account, all the land they owned, it was just confiscated. They just took it all away. They put them on boats, and you either got on the boats or you ended up in jail somewhere and probably died. You got on the boats and they just shipped you out. And everything you had was gone. You had nothing. And that's not what we did when we bought Arizona, New Mexico, and Southern California from Mexico. We honored all of their land grants. And they got to own their land and etc. And we have an article, at least a brief little article explaining that. But the same with Alaska or Louisiana Purchase. When we bought the Louisiana Purchase, was a lot more in Louisiana, went all the way up the Mississippi Valley and everything. We weren't buying all that land. We were buying the property rights that France might claim in that land. They were going to waive any property rights they might have had, you know, all their forts, all their, any lands that they claimed they had a right to, trading areas they had a right to. They were selling that. They weren't selling us the Mississippi River. They didn't own the river. They didn't own all the land. There were Indian tribes there. There were all kinds of people living on this. Americans, everybody. We were just buying out their interest. If the United States were to buy Greenland, they're not buying, you know, the people, I actually hear the people in Greenland saying, we can't buy that. We live here. They're not buying your houses. They're not buying your roads. They're not buying, you know, your refrigerators and your furnishings. They're not buying you. They're buying whatever claim the Netherlands has in Greenland. They claim to have a right. They didn't just, they just stumbled on Greenland. They haven't even explored Greenland. Most of the people that live there are probably not, you know, from Denmark or the Netherlands or any of those places. There were native people that lived there and a lot of other people that have come there since. There's almost nobody living in that entire giant, the biggest island on the face of the earth. They're just buying out their interest. And they really should sell their interest to the United States. Because they can't protect it. And there are people that are moving into areas that are unscrupulous. You know, they've made deals with China already. They really shouldn't do that. It's not safe. It's not wise. Let's put it that way. They can do it. You can do a lot of things that aren't wise. People do it all the time. And you're going to suffer the consequences of it. But the United States could offer more protection. They could sell it to Canada, but I wouldn't advise that. Canada can't even protect itself. It's entirely dependent upon the United States. Now, I'm not telling it what they must do. I'm just saying that there's certain logical advisability of those things. But I don't really care. It's not my decision. You know, it's the decision of the people involved in that. But nobody's actually buying Greenland. They're buying out the interest that somebody else may claim they have in Greenland. That's all they're buying. And that's important to understand in property rights. If I fence off a piece of ground and I plant, you know, plow it up, plant grass in it, grass grows up, I plant trees along the edges, I water the trees, and I cultivate out the weeds, and, you know, now my sweat, my blood, my life is in that grass and in those trees. And if I build a house on it, it's in that house. That gives me a property right. I don't own the land. But I own everything that is coming up out of the land because I maintained it. There were guys who came out to the west and they let a bunch of cows go. They didn't brand them. They just claimed these, you know, that was their cows. There were maybe wild cows there, maybe wild horses there. And they suddenly claimed that they were all theirs. And they said, we own from that mountain to this mountain. And they defend everything in it. You know, Red River, old movie, John Wayne movie, kind of shows that idea that you stake out a piece of ground and you defend it. It's a lot like what Mexico was doing. When Mexico and the United States had their little dispute, and Mexico did some very bad things. Santa Ana did internationally criminal things that his own men were calling him out on. And we could have prosecuted that, and Mexico would be one of the states of the United States. But we didn't. But at that time, probably almost a third of Mexico was occupied by Indians who owed no allegiance to Mexico government. They were doing this thing over here with, you know, Spain and what we call the Mexican government, and then Spain is out, and then France tried to fill the gap, and then eventually Mexico got its sovereignty. But we bought the land from Mexico. We paid them, and they cashed a check. And in our last show, you cashed a check, you consented. And no, you can't go back. But that's how you get property rights. This is why you can have intellectual property rights. You can write a book, and you can go out and publish it. Unless people recognize, you wrote this book, I publish it, you write in it, I have a copyright on this, and they stamp in there the date you publish it. Now the publisher across the street can't take a copy and start printing it and selling it, because he's got a big distribution network, and he sells your book and he makes a fortune, and you make almost nothing. You spent 5 years writing the book, or 10 years in some cases. Guys wrote a book, and then somebody else just comes along and publishes it. And it says, well, you know, but if you put in there that it's copyrighted, he can't do that. That's all copyright is. Now, in order to enforce that, you might depend upon courts. Well, now we're going into another branch of government. If you were in Israel, the way it was originally, under Moses, and there wasn't a lot of, I don't know, there might have been publishing going on, but say that you publish something, and somebody else comes along and they publish it, and they scratch out your name and they put their name in it, and they publish it, and they start, and they're making a fortune off of a book that took you years to write. Is that fair? Is that just? No. It's easy. That's not righteous. But are you going to depend upon professional courts? Or the people's courts to say, you know, look, I said, you know, I'm publishing this for reading purposes only, not so that you can reprint it. That's what copyright means. The right to copy this book remains with me. Just because you bought the book, you can read it, but you can't copy it as if it was yours. That's what a copyright does. It's pretty simple. Now you can get into other intellectual property rights, like you invented something. You know, and of course, to some degree, you know, it might have taken you years of study to invent something, and you don't want somebody to go out and reap all the profits from doing it. So they usually give you a time period on something you invented. You know, the radio was invented in several different places. The airplane was being invented in several different places. And so how much of that can you patent? But all those systems can be corrupted. Justice either flows from the heart of the people or not. Your courts need to flow from the people. They don't anymore, but why? Because you've been slothful, because you've been foolish, because you've elected kings and presidents and prime ministers, because you've coveted your neighbor's goods. You know, over and over again in the Bible, when you set up these systems of covetousness, where you take away from your neighbor to provide you with benefits, there's something that goes along with that. Over and over again in the Bible, your eyes are darkened. Scales are on your eyes. You can't see clearly what is true and what is righteous. So in order to remove those scales, you have to see your covetous practice. That's one of the most important things, is that when you see that you're coveting your neighbor's goods through systems you may call capitalism, seem like you could go start a business, you know, and maybe you're going to need 100 employees, and you either borrow the money, or you take money you already have, and you go out and or rent a building or build a building or buy machinery and learn how to fix it or get guys that know how to fix it, and you hire them to run the machinery, you buy the raw materials, and then you make a product. And you have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you've paid the employees, but you haven't made anything yet. You haven't made any money yet. You're still operating in the red. And you tighten your belt. You work 60 hours a week, 70 hours a week. You go to sleep on the manufacturing floor trying to make it all work, and finally you get it to make it work, and you actually start to turn a profit. And of course, all the workers, they want a share of that profit. You get to decide how much they get. Now, you have to recoup your original investment. You have to recoup, you know, your losses. Maybe you had several failures when you were manufacturing at the beginning. And of course, you see all this. Anybody studies the history of some of the companies of people like Elon Musk, but you can go back, a lot of other guys. And there's always the danger that you're going to value your wealth more than your employees. I see this in company after company. My sons have worked for mills. A couple of my sons have worked for mills. And they come home and they tell me the stories that they work at the mill. And one of the biggest problems in a lot of these big mill-type manufacturing product deals is that they create a hierarchy in the company. It's not even the person who actually originally invested, or they may have even inherited the company. They don't really see it, but the hierarchy in the company doesn't put the employee first. They look at bottom lines. Are we selling enough of the product? Are we making the margins that we make and all this stuff? And they don't realize that the people are the product. But I see a hand coming up, so we're going to take Isabel's call. Isabel, did you have a question?
Yes. It had to do with something I heard you say earlier, and this always comes up for me, and maybe some other people too, but who is my neighbor? That's my question. Like, where I live right now, I have thousands of neighbors. And when I will live in Summer Lake, you'll be my neighbor. But, you know, does it have to do with geography of, like, who your neighbor is?
I think probably the best way to answer who's your neighbor, because we'll look at the rest of the instruction. The instruction is to love thy neighbor as thyself. Okay. The neighbor is almost anybody who's next to you on the subway or next to you on the airplane. So usually it has to do with somebody that is within your influence. You know, maybe your influence is the length of your arm. Maybe your influence, you know, like if you owned a multi-million-dollar company and you have businesses in 40 or 5 different cities. Well, all the people next to within your influence, the people that you can affect, that's your neighbor. But the key word here is not neighbor. The key word here is love. So, now what is love? Love thy neighbor as thyself. If you are doing something really stupid, or about to do something really stupid, that's going to get you in a lot of trouble, but you didn't know it was stupid. You didn't know it was going to get you into trouble. You thought it was a good idea. Maybe you didn't have all the information. Maybe you put it together wrong, whatever. But you were about to make a really big mistake. And your neighbor saw that you were about to make that really big mistake. Do you want your neighbor to point out what that mistake is or not? Well, if you would want your neighbor to point out that mistake, like you're going to take off down this road and you know that the bridge is out or about to go out, or the bridge is not, you know, that it's going to collapse if anybody drives over it. Would you try to tell your neighbor not to go over that bridge? It's dangerous. I think it's about to collapse, or not? Would you want your neighbor to tell you if you are about to drive over that bridge? That's the thing, is a lot of people don't want to tell their neighbor the truth. maybe they're not ready for the truth. I mean, like, are you going to go run out and tell everybody the things that you've heard today on the show? Maybe not. I would guess that a lot of the people in your local community wouldn't want to hear them. Just guessing. But in order to love, your action that could be construed as love, God has to tell you that, because God is love. God has to inspire you in your own heart. Intellectually, you're not going to know how to love your neighbor, when to speak, when not to speak. That you have to be guided into doing that. You have to walk with the Lord. These are things that we see in the Old Testament. Adam and Eve walked with the Lord. They didn't walk with the Lord anymore once they decided to decide for themselves. As a matter of fact, they shunned the light. They fled the light. This is why I say, when you decide in vanity to go your own way and decide what is good and evil for yourself, your eyes will be darkened. One of the ways that you decide for yourself is that you begin to think it's okay to covet my neighbor's goods. I mean, you can say, well, I can steal from the people in France because I don't know anybody in France and they're not my neighbor. And of course, some of that rationality was probably in Caesar when he killed 1 million Gauls and stole their wives and their children. But when he was doing that, they were within his reach. They were within his influence. They were his neighbors. So we can rationalize who is our neighbor, and we can also rationalize what we think is love. And, you know, that's why I wrote the article, Milk and Meat, after a conversation actually with you led me to write that article, is that it was... That it wasn't anything about meat. It wasn't anything about milk. It was about the helicopter mom who drowns their child in too much love. They forgive them all their shortcomings and they end up having more and more shortcomings. You know, a father comes along and he's going to discipline his children. Especially his sons. He says, no, son, you can't do that. You do that, there's going to be, you know, some sort of repercussions, and he can intimidate his son, and his son realizes, oh, dad wouldn't like it if I did this. But the mom might be making excuses all the time, which is a great temptation for mothers, because they naturally will have more compassion, they want the appreciation and love of their child, and so they will be tempted to spoil the child. And the father may not. Now, the father could, of course, discipline the child with impatience and teach the child to be angry. So they both have a responsibility. But that's really what that rule in Moses' writings of Milk and Meat is all about. The woman thinks she's loving by making excuses for her child when it's actually a cruel thing to do. So defining what love is extremely important. We have lots of clues, but ultimately, in a given moment in time, what you should do for your neighbor and what you should not do for your neighbor, and you if you get into the charity business where you have people on the streets or people that are having all kinds of difficulties and they all have these explanations, well, I don't have the money to do this and everything. And you find out the reason he doesn't have the money is he's on a drunken bender for 3 days. And if you give him the money now, he's going to go out on another 3-day drunken bender. So giving him the money is not love. So, yeah, I think everybody within your realm of influence, which could be a very short distance or a very long distance, depending on whatever powers that you're given in life. But the critical phrase there is, what you do, is it really of love, or you want to feel like you're loving them or being kind to them? And you want their appreciation, which actually is a good point to bring up now, because this is why you have altars of clay and stone. Because when the minister gives out an offering, you know, he receives an offering and he redistributes it. according to the council of the stones of the altar, the wood of the altar. That's the council of the stones. And he redistributes it, and in that distribution, that's when it's burnt up. That's when the, you know, the fire redistributes the offering, because the same word for fire is the same word for wife, and the wife is handing out. In some families, when they have four or five people around the table, the wife, or maybe even the husband sometimes, it just depends on their tradition, will dish up each plate and hand it around to everybody. He's redistributing the food that is available, and he gets to do that. If he gives a larger portion to somebody else, that would be strange fire, because why is he doing that? Unless they need it. But if he's doing it to win their favor, then that's strange fire. And that's the danger when you have a priest class, which is just your social welfare officers. If they're handing out more benefits to people they want to win the favor of, that's strange fire. They're to hand out the benefits according to the true needs, according to love, according to what will make that person stronger. Because that was the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, or Sodom was in a time of affluence when they had all this money coming in. They did not strengthen the poor. The system of welfare weakened the poor. And of course, we could do a whole show, and we have articles on it. Social welfare from LBJ wasn't love. It weakened the communities. Oh, it certainly helped out some people. And some people survived it, went on. You know, they needed help for a short period of time, and they got the help. And then I knew a girl whose husband, she was like 8 months pregnant or 7 months pregnant. And her husband was just not going to work and not looking for a job and lying to her. And he eventually beat her up, almost had to put her into the hospital. And of course she left him, and she went on welfare very short period of time, got a job, had a baby, got a job, got off of welfare, completely off of welfare, never went back, never looked back. But I know other women who went on welfare and were on welfare for years and years and years and years, and they didn't need to be. And when you gave them an opportunity to get off of it, they didn't. And their whole life was destroyed because they were on welfare. So, the reason why is the state will just keep giving you the check. But a minister of God, he's got to give to you in a way that will strengthen you. Otherwise, he's not given to you like God. So, and that's love. Sometimes it's tough love. No, I'm not going to give you any money this week, because I saw you in the bar drinking it up. And I'm not going to encourage that. You got to go cold stone sober. Or I'm not going to give you any help. I'll feed your kids when they come by, but I'm not giving you any food. And that's real love, because love has to be tough. So I don't know if I really answered, but your neighbors, anybody within your influence, it has to do with proximity. Now, you can have your enemies be your neighbor, but you know, even Moses says you give drink to your enemy, and Jesus says you were to love your enemy. And sometimes loving your enemy may be throwing him to the ground and putting handcuffs on him because he's out of control. And he's going to hurt somebody or get somebody hurt if you don't do that. So love can come in many forms. Yeah, if there's any other questions, just pop that hand up and I'll try to answer it. But there's a lot more on the page that we have on capitalism, because I quote The Enterprise of Law by Dr. Bruce Benson, that is, our modern reliance on government to make law and establish order is not the historical norm. And there's several other people that I quote that Abraham would not even take a buckle from the city of blood of Sodom, the cauldron of Sodom, the corporate state of Sodom. Because the king of Sodom bearer was turning all the people into human resources. He says, you can have all the stuff Abraham, just give me back the people, because once the people are back, my subjects, my livestock, the ones I can shear, the ones that I can take a portion of their labor. See, everybody, they think for some reason, oh, some corporation made a lot of money off of their workers' labors. They don't look at the books. They don't know the overhead and the expenses that he has, but they just see that he's got a big fancy car or fancy house, and maybe he's too self-indulgent. Who knows? We can write all kinds of stories. But if you think socialism will do away with that, no. Because in capitalism, yes, you will find men who exploit men. That always happens. And in capitalism, you will find it, but you also find men who enrich men, create jobs, create livelihoods, so they can buy homes and raise their families. So you have that too in capitalism. But in socialism, you will find that men exploit men. And if we look at the history of socialism, it fails over and over again. And like, I'll leave you with this, Polybius's quote, that when men develop an appetite for benefits and the habit of receiving them at the expense of others, they institute the rule of force and violence. And the people degenerate into perfect savages until they find once more a monarch and a king. We see in the streets with the past riots and the riots that they're trying to foment. They're not having these riots in all the other states that aren't sanctuary cities. They're not having these difficulties. Most of the illegals that were brought in by the Democratic Party in order to increase the number of seats in Congress are being deported, but most of them have already moved to sanctuary cities where they have protection and they get a lot more benefits and everything. Evidently, Walz just had he called out the National Guard and having them feed and give coffee to the rioters, which he calls demonstrators, which is, you know, whose fault is it that all this is happening? We can blame it on Walz. We can blame it on Frey. We can blame it on the Democratic Party. But really, the one who's to blame is the people. Because they're not following Christ. They're not following Moses. Christ and Moses were doing the same thing. They're not following Abraham. But, to be fair, they don't know. Their eyes have been dimmed, and they sit in darkness. Well, hopefully we've brought a little bit of light. People can think about it. Then go to preparingyou.com or hisholychurch.org. But better yet, is join the network as close to where you live as possible. If you live in Oregon, if you live in Texas, join the networks and form congregations, even if you only call each other up, and start figuring out how to help one another. And you can figure out that between you and God, because they're all free assemblies. But to turn around your thinking, you have to act upon what your thoughts are telling you. And hopefully, the more you listen to God, the more you will hear from God. But until then, all I can say is peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. I hope this helps. God bless. For more information, go to hisholychurch.org or preparingyou.com. Join the network. Listen to the audios at most podcast providers under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Thanks, everyone, and God bless. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X.